You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Comedy Cellar Show here on Sirius XM Channel 99. We're here upstairs from the Comedy Cellar, not downstairs where we usually are, because, and I'm here, of course, with our producer, Perry L. Ashenbrunn, and my co-host, Mr. Dan Natterman. And we have one of our best guests ever. Dan, I'll let you do the introduction.
You want me to do the introduction?
Please do. Please do.
Our guest today is Mr. Michael J. Fox. And he needs no introduction, but I'll do one anyway. The recipient of countless awards, 5 Emmys, 4 Golden Globes, 2 SAG Awards. At age 29, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, which he shared publicly in 1998. In 2000, he established the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. In 2011, he received the Order of Canada, which I guess is like our...
Mueller report.
I don't know. And him and his wife, actress Tracy Pollan, have 4 children. They live in Manhattan. Michael, thanks for coming.
Hey. My pleasure. You did that trippingly.
I did that what?
Trippingly. It was beautiful.
Michael, I performed at your Parkinson's benefit 2 years ago.
Great approbation.
Oh, thank you. I was told that you were a fan of mine. But I'm not sure if that's true. Maybe I was just...
Yeah, no, absolutely. They gave me a list of comics that were willing to do the show, and I saw your name on the list, and I said, I haven't seen him. He's funny.
Oh, okay.
And you proved me right. You were tremendous.
And you made the mistake of giving me your phone number.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is the reason you're here today, because...
I like the voice you used last week, by the way. that heavy voice you used. Remember when you call, you do the high, flighty voice, but you did the low, heavy, serious.
The creepy
one. I really liked it a lot.
And that's what drew you in.
That's it. You had me.
So thank you for coming. And how are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing great. I'm doing well. I'm stumbling a little bit. I climbed like 8 flights of stairs to get up here. Which, you know, I don't think the cane might have been a tip-off that might be tough for me, but...
Now I feel guilty because I said, why are we doing it upstairs? Are the stairs a problem? And she told me the stairs were...
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I'm sorry.
Mission accomplished. I did it. I'm up here. I'm up here for life. I'm going to be up in this room forever. I'm looking around trying to see where I'm going to sleep and make a nest.
Michael, you wrote a book in, I think it was... In the early 2000s called Lucky Man. 2002 called Lucky Man. And you said that the years since your diagnosis of Parkinson's have been some of the most fulfilling years of your life.
And as you say, that's just proven more so ever since then. It's been really interesting because can I use profanity?
Yeah, go ahead.
Please do.
You get a shit sandwich and you realize it's something to eat. I mean, you're not starving, and it's just you find the good stuff at the edges of the bad stuff, and I've been put in situations and met people and given opportunities to do things. That with the foundation, we've raised over $800 million for research.
It's incredible.
I mean, that to get an opportunity to do that. I mean, you can't whine about that. That's just great, and it's given me an appreciation for my family and for my kids and for my work when I'm able to do it. And I have to adjust my work because I don't have the same tools that I used to have to do the things I used to do. And now I find new ways to do it. And so life's just opened up in a way. Things close down, but things open up.
So would you say that this is among the happiest times of your life? You look back on your life and you say, well, what was the happiest time? Was it when you were the biggest star on planet Earth?
Every day I wake up it sounds sucky and maudlin and trite and treacly, but it's true. It's just every day I wake up, I have 4 kids I love, and I got a wife that's fantastic, and she keeps me around, and I love the work that I'm able to do with the foundation. I love the work. I love writing. I'm writing another book. I love acting when I get a chance to do it, and so it's all good, and.
You have a better attitude than I do.
Can I ask you a question?
And yeah, go ahead.
What advice? You know, we all get so upset about things that are, you know, and we react to little things in our lives the way we react to big things. What advice do you give somebody to how to keep things in perspective about what's going on in their lives?
I have a lot of these things that are really available to me that I think are true. Which is, one is that if you imagine the worst case scenario and it actually happens, you've lived it twice. Don't go through shit and experience all this stuff and think about it, fret about it, because if it happens, you've already gone through all that shit. Now you get through it again.
Well, you know what Shakespeare said from Julius Caesar? Cowards die many times before their deaths.
Yeah.
The valiant never taste of death just once. It seems to me most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, a necessary end, will come when it will come.
We must have had lessons.
Out of brief candle, life is but a walking shadow.
Well, that's Macbeth.
The player that stretches and fretches out upon the stage and there's heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Did you just call him an idiot?
We're having a Shakespeare off. Michael J. Fox.
My 11th grade education, that's as far as I go.
So
the point is don't stress it until it happens.
Yeah, there's stuff that you can't do anything about, and if you're focusing on that, you're not dealing with the stuff you can do something about. Like I put it like with Parkinson's and the other stuff I dealt with more recently. I had some spinal issues and but went through massive rehabilitation and it's just that, like, I find that if I accept something, if I say, okay, this is it, this is what I have. And I look at it and I weigh it and I measure it and I look at it. I'm not afraid to look at any part of it. I'm not afraid to go into any aspect of it, any possibility that it might bring about. But just really look at it, then I got it. I got it nailed. And then it's only going to take up the space it takes up. It's not going to be this amorphous blob that eats all my life with dread and worry and fills every cranny. Because I know what it is. And now that leaves room for me to do other stuff. I can identify areas that I can go in and flourish. Because I know what the big boogeyman is.
Do you have a spiritual life, or you believe in some higher power that might be have planned this out so that?
No, I don't believe there's a
pardon.
There's a reason for there's a purpose behind this.
So you're not one of those guys.
No.
So I have just one other thing that I always think about, and this I've thought about this many times. Preceding meeting you, there are certain people in all walks of life that I notice, like who deal with challenges that I can't imagine. And I wonder what you all have in common. For instance, just off the top of my head, like Charles Krauthammer was, you know, paraplegic and a quadriplegic. And Rush Limbaugh is deaf. And there's this other deaf comedian who's performing.
I love the people you're putting me in with.
Well, no, I'm so, you know, I was actually I was afraid to say it. I say, is that going to
be
Christopher
an insult?
But I'm saying people who overcome the psychological stress that would crush me. My wife knows me. I'd be afraid to get. I just would not be able to get out of bed. I would be so sorry for myself. So I mean, what do you guys all have in common? You're like, fuck this. This is not going to stop me. I'm moving on with my life.
I don't know. I think that it's just a gratitude for you know, again, it's this idea of a higher power or whatever. The other thing I do close to that is meditation, and I meditate. And what I like about meditating is that like you'll be meditating, and a thought will come into your head, and the idea is to see that thought, to recognize it, to respect it, and let it go. And it just has I have nothing to do with it today. I have no room for it on my plate to deal with that thing. And so it's just thought, okay, see it, let it go. And that applies to everything. It's like something comes into your thing and you haven't got an answer for it. Well, let it go and it'll come back again another time and you maybe have an answer for it. So I don't freak out about stuff. It's like if you, when I had this spinal surgery about a year ago, and they told me it takes 2 years to recover from it, and I had to learn how to walk again, and I had to do all that stuff. And I mean, when I say to learn how to walk again, I mean I really had to learn how to transfer the energy from my right butt cheek into my left leg and take that weight and then transfer it again and think about all those steps and really literally take things one step at a time. And when you break it down like that, You haven't got room for all the goofy shit. You're just trying to get across the room without falling down. Like I learned how to walk again in finally August. I had the surgery in April, and by August I was walking by myself. I didn't have a cane anymore. I didn't have the walker. I went through all that stuff in a wheelchair, and it was really tough. And then I was walking again. So my family was at the beach, and I came into the city to do a shoot on a movie. They asked me to do a cameo on it, and I thought, this is great. I'm going to do a cameo on this movie. I'm walking. I'm feeling great. And I walked into my kitchen, and I was alone in the house, and I slipped on the tile and went down and fractured my arm, a spiral fracture of my humerus, and just trashed my arm. I got 20 pins in that plate. And it was just a great, fuck you. It was just a great, like, you can't ever take that next step for granted. When you watch every step, or appreciate every step, you just love life. You just see the stuff that works, and you really appreciate it.
You got to remember, Noam, he's from Western Canada, and there are hardier people there, I think, than the northeastern variety.
I just can't express how much I admire that, and I hope I could, you know, learn from that. Michael, talk about talk about some of the movies and stuff.
When you were at the height of everything, and you were, and Perry L, our producer, had posters of you all over her wall, by the way. But that shouldn't come as a surprise.
I didn't even know you were like a teen heartthrob. I didn't realize that.
Oh my God, are you kidding?
I didn't realize.
In every teen
magazine. I can explain this to my daughters. They don't believe it.
Well, you're never.
How old are your daughters?
They're now 24 and 20 and 17. But
well, you're never going to be cool in the eyes of your children. No. Even if, I mean, Noam's not cool anyway.
No, they call me dude. My kids call me dude, and I said. Is dude like the Big Lebowski dude? And I said, no, dude like duty.
when you were in those days, back in the Back of the Future and Family Ties era. Did you ever think, I mean, obviously, and I don't know if you ever thought this far forward in life. Did you have any thoughts about what your life might be 20 years out, what your career might be 20 years out? Or did you not even think that far?
I didn't have the time. So I met my wife, and then I started to think long term, and like realized that I had to like figure something out. Because I was as kind of enlightened and zen like that I am now. I was like a maniac. I was 24 years old. I had a Ferrari and a Range Rover and a Mercedes 560 SL and a Nissan 300 ZX and I was just going to the improv every night and all these clubs and just getting smashed and partying and living like there's no tomorrow and that was gonna run out. That if I kept on that track, it would have been in trouble. But
so you knew that even then, as a young person, and young people usually feel they're invincible, but you knew that this had to change.
Well, when I met Tracy, and she kind of said, you know, you're on a track that's not good. And I realized that it didn't mean I stopped drinking right away. It took me a while, but it was crazy. It was a crazy time. I thought it was a rock star. I thought it was.
Well, you were. I mean, you were effectively.
You're still a rock star.
Is this the same time that you did that movie about the guy with the drug problem?
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah,
Bright
Lights, Big City.
Was that a similar time that you were going through these thoughts?
Yeah, I wasn't doing much coke, but I was drinking a lot of whiskey. And it was pretty out there.
What thoughts would, in terms of your career? What did you have any thoughts about where your career might go after all of this? Did you have any particular? Did you want to direct or write or?
I wanted to write films, and I wanted to do films of you know, comedies and dramatic films and other kinds of work, but. But I think that I didn't have a I mean, it, when once I was diagnosed, then it became about just doing as much work as I could, because they told me I had 10 years left to work. And so I decided I got to cram as much work into this as I can. And then that didn't work out. It wasn't fruitful. So it's all that stuff, all the career stuff, it's hard to, like, I look at it now, and it's interesting, but it's not the big stuff to me.
Can I ask a question, because this is what worries me. Is there a bubble over your head saying at some point, it's like, why are they keep asking me about all this Parkinson's stuff. Why don't they, you know, like, I'd love to talk about what it was like to be on the set of Back to the Future and stuff like that. Is that, like, because there's a whole, like, there's a whole Michael J. Fox universe of stuff that we all grew up with that we're fascinated by that I don't want to pass over in this half an hour. I don't know. I don't know how you feel about that stuff.
I'm game for anything. I'll talk about
it. What in your career are you most proud of all the things you've done in your showbiz career?
Well, I think
prior to your film,
what was the most fun?
The double whammy of doing Back to the Future and Family Ties was just, I mean, the fact that that happened, it was incredible to do both those things and to work with Bob Zemeckis and to work with Gary Goldberg, who's passed away since. And
the next thing you know, it's the 60s. You turn around, there's a women's movement. I was born too late, Dad. I should have been born in the 50s.
Even then, you'd be a little on the conservative side.
The 1750s.
Do your kids watch? Did they watch?
No, they
nothing.
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. My son must have been like 18 before he saw Back to the Future, but my son, like, I mean, imagine. I was talking about this before to somebody, to you, about my kids. I can't imagine what it was like. I grew up in Canada. Like, my dad was in the military. My mom was a payroll clerk. I made strange enough money together to let me play hockey, and I went to a school for at-risk kids, and I mean, I just had a normal life, and then my kids grew up in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, went to private schools, went to great universities, and had famous parents, and so their experience is different. I mean,
so
but they seem to like me, and
how were you discovered?
I did a movie in Canada with Art Carney and Maureen Staple, and I worked a lot in Canada doing kid stuff, and I did this American movie, and they went down to the States, and I started to get calls from agents in the States, based on what the producers and others had said about me, about this kid in Canada, who by the way, and this was no small part of it, was 18 but looked, or almost 18 but looked 13. And so it became easy to get me visas because I was valuable and then I could help them avoid child labor laws.
Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, that is interesting.
And it gave me a leg up. And
did your parents think you were insane coming from that background?
My parents thought I was insane anyway. I mean, I was a crazy kid. I was like as tall as this bottle. And I was
let the record show he's pointing to a poem.
Well, you're running around spouting out all those conservative Reagan views, and
I've always been a lefty, so it's been an interesting part of my journey too, being a poster boy for an ideology that I don't really subscribe to.
Is it true that they wanted people always say I look like him,
Matthew Broderick,
for the role of Alex?
Yeah,
P. Keaton.
He wanted Matthew, and he. Gary, he didn't want to. I came in and read for him. I was the first guy that read for the part, and it was good material, and I had a take on it. But this guy was kind of a smart ass, and Gary hated me, and so for the next month, Judith Wiener, the casting director, really wanted me to go back. I wanted Gary to see me again, and Gary said, like, Judith, I'm a grown man. I know what I like. I know what I don't like, and I don't like this kid. I don't think he's good. I don't want to see him. I want Matthew, and we can't get Matthew. We get somebody else. And so finally she prevailed on him when they couldn't find anybody to just give me one shot. So I came in and for some reason just that day, I mean, you know what it's like, just that day just the shit was happening and I just was in the pocket and he became my champion right away. And he this is kind of a funny story. He went to the network and went to bat for me to get me on the show. I did the pilot. And it went really well, and it was really Alex centric, and so right away you could kind of see where this character could go. But the network, Warren Littlefield, Brandon Tartikoff, didn't like me, and now Gary was in the shoes on the other foot. Gary was saying, this guy's great, this kid's great, and he said, I give him two jokes, he gives me three laughs, and that was his argument, and Brandon said, I can't see his face on a lunchbox. And Gary said, so that's the criteria. Like, he has to look good on a lunchbox. So to Brandon's credit, when Back to the Future hit, and Family Ties was the number two show in the country, and Back to the Future was the number one movie, and Teen Wolf was the number two movie, He cut. He said, "You know what? How stupid I am." I said, "Michael Fox never looked good in a lunchbox." So I had a lunchbox made with my picture on it, and I signed it to Brandon. "This is for you to put your crow in."
But Brandon also thought that Seinfeld was too Jewish, I think,
yeah,
and was also poo-pooed Seinfeld. You thought maybe
really
he would have learned.
Funny.
But he was a great guy. To his credit, he put that down on his desk and kept it.
That's awesome.
Did you have a Michael J. Fox lunchbox, Perry?
No, I just had posters all over my room.
The posters, yeah.
Yeah, I had a Fantastic Four lunchbox.
I was on the ceilings of a lot of...
There's a comic here, by the way, that made out with your poster.
Oh, really?
Yeah, our very own Rachel Feinstein, who was on The Tonight Show.
Why did we get her on the show?
We tried to, but she's in Aruba with Aruba Ray.
So, Back to the Future. I was flipping through the channels the other day, and it was on. But by the way, it holds up. I think it's kind of like The Wizard of Oz. I think they're going to watch it 100 years from now.
I was related to that. It was The Wizard of Oz. I remember, like, Wizard of Oz, before there was viewing platforms and cable TV and DirecTV and all the stuff we have now. Like they played it every year at Thanksgiving or Christmas or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And that's the only time you saw it. So you waited to see it. And then I don't know, all the way through my teenage years, when then I started to try to match it up with The Dark Side of the Moon and do that. But yeah, that's the thing. And kids really love it. And it's strange because we're now, well, you know, we passed the time when we went to in the future. That was like a big event a few years ago. And people are still crazy about it. I mean, when I go to the airport, there's like 30 people with hoverboards, and I don't know how they figure out what flight I'm on. I mean, I book a flight at 4 o'clock for 5 o'clock, and I'll get there, port at 5, and there'll be 20 people there with out of time license plates, and it's just people are just
it's crazy. It's magical. It's one of those things.
I always I try to make a joke about how in all movies about time travel, the guy who invents a time machine, it's always far and away his best invention.
Yeah.
You know, like he's got like something to keep coffee hot, you know, maybe like, you know what I'm saying? Like everything else is, he's bent time and space, but every other invention kind of sucks.
Yeah.
It never got laughs either at the club.
Give him a laugh, Mike. So,
but what did Dr. Brown...
I didn't get to ask my question. So you actually play the guitar?
Yeah,
that's what I because it looked like in the Chuck in the Johnny B. Goode scene that you're actually playing the guitar.
When I came onto the movie, there was another actor who did the role for about 5 weeks before they brought me in, and so a lot of stuff was shot and a lot of stuff was recorded. Like that was all recorded, and that track existed. So, but I said to them, I said, you know, just when you're shooting this, just so you know, I can play this, so you can shoot my hands. And so that kind of went both ways because it said like I'll do this and I'll play the notes, but be on my hands at the right time, like when the right notes are playing.
All right, because you.
But Dean Cundey was a brilliant photographer, and they got it, and I worked with this choreographer who was Madonna's choreographer at the time. I don't know how many she probably went through a lot of choreographers, but he was great. This guy, I wish I could remember his name. And we went through. He said, "What do you want to do here?" And I said, "I like that. Maybe just go through all my guitar heroes. Let's go through like Townsend and Page and Chuck Berry, of course." And I was so sensitive to the fact that I had some feelings about a white kid showing inventing rock and roll. I mean, it was a little touch and go for me.
Yeah.
He didn't invent it. You got it from Chuck Berry, and then you went back in time and gave it back to him.
Johnny B. Goode. Chuck, it's Marvin. Your cousin, Marvin Berry. You know that new sound you're looking for? Well, listen to this.
Yeah, but it's just, it's, I mean, yeah.
But I hear what you're saying.
There was no bad intent behind it. It was just one of those things. Like
today, it might actually have been controversial. That's just what you're saying.
It might have been. I mean, and it wasn't intended to be controversial. Yeah. And so that's why I put into the thing that it was all these guitar heroes, Jimi Hendrix, and who did we do? We did Townsend. We did Van Halen. We did. I went through a list of them, and we worked it all in, and it was so much fun, and to this day, I play. It's a medley of my hit. I play it at at our benefit every year. I play it with whoever guest we have. I play it with Chris Martin and Brad Paisley and Dave Matthews. And
now that was the year I was there, was Dave Matthews.
Dave Matthews, we did it all along the Watchtower.
Awesome.
That's cool.
Yeah, Noam's a very accomplished guitarist.
Well, whatever.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of guitars here.
Yeah, a lot of guitars.
Yeah, because he likes to play every...
Is that an extra...
That's my father's 1950s Gibson Birdland that he played. Yeah,
that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
They do have music here every Friday night Noam plays. And I'm sure Noam would comp your kebab.
Half price.
Half price.
I don't drink, so you have to... Diet Cokes for $3.
You want a Pepsi free? But seriously.
More recently, I'm remiss not to tell you how fantastic I thought you were on the Curb Your Enthusiasm episode.
Oh, thank you.
That was really one of the great episodes of Curb, of which there were many.
You know what was great about that show was not so much me. I don't love the kid. The kid with the sewing machine.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Way to Nazi uniforms.
Can you get me one?
A swastika?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Jews would like that.
Get a life, Jews.
Okay.
It was so fun. You were so funny.
That was really fun. That was it was great because you could literally do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then an improv vibe. I didn't know how real it was. I didn't know how. Whether they called the improv and Larry just gave you lines, which he did, but he just gave me freedom to do whatever I wanted to do.
That part where he drew a Hitler mustache
on my father-in-law,
was that a real magazine cover of your father-in-law?
Yeah, my father-in-law.
This is fishing, but you were at the same time walking kind of the same earth. Did you know Michael Jackson? Do you have experiences with him during that height of his?
I met Michael Jackson a few times. I met him one time and I went to his house and to meet him, and I got very quickly. He was lovely and he was really nice and welcoming. But he had just bought the Beatles catalog, the Northern Songs catalog, and I wanted to talk to him about that. I mean, buy the Beatles catalog. I mean.
From under Paul McCartney, yeah.
Out from under Paul McCartney. I mean, it was just such a ballsy move, and it was so canny, and so, and we didn't talk about that. We talked about his giraffe and
his giraffe.
Well, he had the animals, and he was sweet. I know all the stuff about him that's been revealed and talked about, and I can't speak to that. But then later on, I referred to in interview I did the other day to one time I was walking through we were at a Pepsi convention in Hawaii, and I walked by him and it was him and Bubbles was there, and I just kind of said, "Hey, Mikey, Bubbles," and walked by and said, "That was weird."
What else, Dan? What else?
Well, you mentioned one of your kids it wants to be in show business, wants to be a producer.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about? A kid following in your footsteps in show business.
Well, I mean, none of my kids want to be entertainers. I have one daughter who was a pretty accomplished ballerina, and she went to college on the strength of that, and other things. I mean, she's a good student. And my youngest is she's like the future president of the United States. I don't know. She can do anything she wants to do, and all my kids are like that. And my son. He did that kind of millennial thing where he had like 9 careers in 5 years, and then decided he wanted to get involved in independent film. So he went to work at an agency and is going up through the ranks there. And so we'll see what he does.
But, does the Fox name helping him at all, or not really?
Don't hurt.
I don't think he puts that in his arsenal. I don't think he leads with that. He was a good student and went to a good school and is a good guy and smart and funny. Like I say, he's taller than me, better looking than me, and smarter than me. So I did my job in the Darwinian chain. I gave him just enough, and my wife gave him all the good stuff, and he's doing great.
No, would you say that about your children, that your wife gave them all the good stuff?
That's my wife, by the way.
That's your wife over there.
I always say anything good is my wife's fault.
That's the right thing to say.
The opposite.
I don't know. I do know the following.
Came from me.
That a lot of times the children of very, very talented people are actually also very, very talented people. And sometimes people want to think that they're not because just because you're dead. But no, it's they're actually talented because it's passed down quite often, I believe.
Well, this goes back to when you asked me about my kids watch the shows and stuff. They didn't really, and they didn't express much interest in it. And I always took that as a compliment because they didn't want to know that part of me that wasn't important to them. It didn't relate that who I was to other people was secondary to them to who I was to them.
That's so interesting. Like, you're just their dad.
Yeah, someone goes, "Your dad, he's a great man." It's like, look at him like.
right.
Well, my kids, I mean, obviously, I'm not famous or anything, but you know, my kids don't care at all about anything that goes on at the Comedy Cellar until one thing happened. Ant-Man showed up. Mm. When Ant-Man came to the Comedy Cellar with Jeff Ross, right? Now daddy's important. Ant-Man was at the club. But other than that, Paul Rudd showed up. Other than that, they couldn't care less.
Paul Rudd is cool.
Yeah, that was, their dad
your
did something.
Kids are young.
Yep, sweetheart.
If you want to talk,
you have to talk on a microphone. She's not that technically inclined.
See right there. This is
hot wife, right?
Yeah.
Do you still like that? Do you still, you know, that song when you and Tracy on Family Ties? That, you know, the Billy Vera and the Beatles.
That song drives us crazy.
Do you like, or you can't stand listening to it? Was
There was a time we couldn't walk into a bar or a restaurant where they didn't stop whatever they're doing and play that song, and it just grew to haunt us. it's a lovely song, but it's the 137th listening, it doesn't hold up. But Billy Vera and the Beatles were a great band,
they were made, I guess, by their association with you and Tracy and with that scene.
I knew them before they did that song, before we were associated with it. I knew them from just the bars in L.A. They were just a great band you'd go and listen to. And
they were in that movie Blind Date with Bruce Willis and Kim Basinger. I remember they did a scene there.
Yeah, they were good. But it drove me crazy. I'd hear it in my sleep.
Well, I do have it on my phone, but I will refrain from playing it. Although I still like it, but I haven't heard it as many times. People don't play it when I walk into a room.
That's your ringtone?
No, but what's ahead in terms of your foundation? If we can get back to that topic,
we've just got a couple of drugs through the
FDA,
which is a big thing for us. We've worked with drug companies for years and in trying to get them to de-risk. We de-risk things for them. We like say, this compound we want you to look at. They say we don't have any interest in Parkinson's per se, or they may not have a program for it. We'll say, we'll fund it. We'll fund it early on. And if you get follow-on funding and you find something, great. And just promise us you'll share what you get through that follow-on funding. And that happened several times, and we've had big breakthroughs with that. We're also looking. We put a lot of money into finding a biomarker, which is a way to identify the disease before symptoms are evident. Because by the time my pinky twitched in 1991 in Micanopy, Florida, when I was doing Doc Hollywood, by the time that happened, 70% of the dopamine-producing cells in my brain were already dead. So we don't have a way to identify the disease before us, but we're getting close to that. And then therefore finding a way to treat it prophylactically so that we know you may be fine, you're a 20-year-old man, you're in good shape, but we know you're going to get Parkinson's because we've got the biomarkers, and now we can treat you with it. We can target drugs to treat that, and it may not be a cure, but it'll never progress and you'll never have symptoms.
Well, is it in your case, was it just bad luck or was there any genetic predisposition? If we're going to look at young people and try to see if they might be susceptible to this, do we target specifically people with family history?
Some of the things we've done as a foundation is we've helped identify genes for the first time. There was a hunch that genetics loaded the gun and environment pulled the trigger. In other words, you were predisposed, and certain factors became evident, acted on your pre-existing condition. But that was just a theory. We've now found genes, several genes that are directed. There's one particularly that called LRRK2. I can't think of what the acronym is for off the top of my head, but it's identified with Ashkenazi Jews, and so we now can go into the Ashkenazi population and solicit them for testing, and we have a huge data bank that didn't exist before we came into existence. We have a huge through this biomarker initiative that we have, and through registry of patients and a thing we have called Fox Insight, where people share their experience in a narrative that explains what each individual situation is, because Parkinson's is very different with different patients. Everyone has their own experience. So we collect all this data and make it available to anybody who wants to access it, any scientists, and we get a tremendous understanding of different patient populations. We've now realized that there are certain things, like if you have a lack of sense of smell, your sense of smell is diminished. That's an indicator.
Now, what you're giving me is hypochondriacal fodder, unfortunately. because sometimes, like, I feel maybe I'll smell something that's not there, and I'll run to the computer and say, smell, not there, and it'll say you're dying. But you know how that goes. Yeah, I'm a hypochondriac. But you're from Western Canada, so you don't know anything about that.
As I say, I don't have a doctor in the family, but I have the next best thing. My wife is a hypochondriac.
She's an Ashkenazi Jew from the East Coast.
Yes, exactly. And she can diagnose a disease. I mean, like weird stuff. Like you have Alder's muscle spasm or something. She can just look at what you have and say, you know, you're gonna die.
what can we do to help? I don't know why I've done
my part. I performed at his fundraiser.
No, can we do a night at the Comedy Cellar? We donate to your foundation or something like that.
Figure out something like that. That'd be great.
I would love to do that. If you have somebody contact us, we'd be happy to do that. We'll take a show.
For us, what's really great is just to have people aware of what we're doing, and the thing that broader message we have is that beyond just Parkinson's, we're really in the forefront, private disease foundations, of pushing the envelope of how this is done. I mean, when we started, we had Kitty Hawk, and we're trying to build the space shuttle, and so it's been a long journey, but it has interest to anybody who cares about MS, ALS, Huntington's, any of these neurological diseases that. Because if we crack one, it's going to be like dominoes.
So where can people go to learn more?
I just go to michaeljfox.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Does anybody?
We're done? Okay.
Unless anybody has any closing remarks or...
No, I'm just, you know, this could sound corny and you probably hear this, but I can't help it. I'm feeling it. I'm just very, very inspired by you and the way you control your psychology, really, to move on. I take inspiration from that, my own stupid problems, and I really appreciate you coming.
I know I'm aware of your problems, and they're not stupid. They're in
You met one of them, but...
Noam's,
I got 99 problems, but so she's not one.
She's not one.
Noam's problem is he's got... Noam's biggest problem is he's got so many reservations.
Yeah.
And he can't figure out how to cram more people
all right.
less space at the Comedy Cellar.
All right.
He's been very blessed, Noam Dorman, is what I'm trying to say. But,
Tell him, Dan. We honestly would be very happy to take a show at the Comedy Cellar.
We did something together with at the gallery, right? With Muhammad, with Muhammad Ali, which you said is one of your favorite pictures,
Yeah,
right?
Mark Seltzer's picture of me with Muhammad Ali is just amazing.
This, by the way, your life is like Doc Hollywood. You came in all brash and young, and then you know you were right in Doc Hollywood. You kind of were all Mr. Big Shot. You wanted to be a plastic surgeon. Then you realized what was really important.
Yeah,
well, I don't know if that
sleeping with a girl in the country.
Pardon?
sleeping with a country girl from North Carolina. That's what he did. He met a girl. So it was just he was converted by it.
He was converted into country living.
Yeah.
Okay, Mrs. Owens, if you could please get up on the table, put your feet in the stirrups.
We're just here about our mail.
It's from my sister. We don't read.
Did you ever see that movie, Noah?
I haven't seen that
it's
movie.
It's Winchester from MASH is in it. But he doesn't have that weird accent. It's very disconcerting.
Yeah, he's a southern accent.
Yeah, but I don't know how he talks in real life.
He's the one who stuttered.
He passed away.
He was the one in MASH that was like, Thank you. No.
Yeah, he played a role in an old Mary Tyler Moore show too, where he stuttered. He played the network executive. It was jarring to see him as that too.
It's just weird to see him without that accent. Anyway, Michael, thank you. I can't believe you showed up. I'll be honest with you. I sent him a text and I said he'll never get back to me.
I've been since you did our show, I've been wanting to get together and
well, you know, obviously you can come here. I mean, Noam's a club owner, but I can speak on his behalf in this case that anytime you and your and or your son and any member of the Fox family wants to come down here for a show, obviously they're welcome.
I had to make sure my passport was up to date before I came this far down.
And hummus half off.
All right. Thank you, sir. Good night, everybody. Good night.